Hi, this is a lecture on Dorfman and Matalart's text, How to Read Donald Duck, which is quite dense and quite lengthy, but I think I can reduce down some of the basic points that they're making. I'll give a somewhat shorter lecture than I did on the board, where I spent maybe too long kind of setting up the backdrop. But I do want to start by saying something about the context of the production of this text as well. And then again, you can check out the notes, and I've really simplified what's going on in the text and the notes, but I think I have represented it fairly well nevertheless. I've basically just gotten rid of the entire Marxist vocabulary, and much is lost in that way. So if you really want to get what's going on, you got to look at the text itself. Anyway, so this is a text written, you know, in a lot of ways about an aspect of the spectacle. And specifically, it's focused on the way that U.S. values, the ideas of capitalism, the ideas of competition, the ideas of the free market, what they would say is the bourgeois ideology, which suggests that business, entrepreneurship, private enterprise is the best shit there is in the world, that consuming, shooting for financial success is the fundamental way of life that everybody should have. These contents of the United States ideology are not limited to the culture of the United States, because the United States is increasingly, well, it was increasingly in 1971, now maybe it's decreasingly, a world power. And of course, we still are a world power, and we're the largest and most powerful military in the world, and we're also the primary producer of representational material, of media in the world. We still have Hollywood. So this is 1971 in Chile, and they're responding to the inundation of their culture with our culture. And I even hesitate to say our culture, because if you've followed the logic of these past few Marxist-related interpretations, we should be hesitant to say that this is our culture. The ideology that is given to us is, at least according to this theory, primarily the ideology of the ruling class, not the ideology of the working class. But that ideology of our ruling class also becomes the ideology of ruled, colonized, occupied, imperially controlled, either directly by means of troops, etc., or indirectly by means of propping up usually dictatorial regimes across the rest of the world, so that American capital has access to those markets and access to that labor. That ideology has been imposed upon the rest of the world. Okay, so this is what they're responding to. But we should also recognize that this is a very specific and important historical moment in which these two guys are writing. So they're in Chile, and the book comes out in 1971. So this is the period during which Salvador Allende had risen to power. And Allende was a radical socialist reformer who, like Hugo Chavez later, and like, say, Mossadegh in Iran earlier, moved to nationalize resources, nationalize industry, push foreign capital, which was, and this is what foreign capital does everywhere, deriving profit on the backs of colonized territories. Allende moved to push those things out. So there's this brief moment of like real socialist revolution happening in 1971, and that is the context in which this stuff is written. So the passion with which it is written corresponds to the passion of the real historical moment in Chile. So Chile had been subject to American imperial influence, American propping up of military regimes, American ownership, American corporate ownership. And I shouldn't really say American, right? Because Chile is American. United States capitalistic control over resources, labor, and markets and Chile. That had been the case before Allende. But then Allende shows up, and this movement to alter the fundamental pattern of life and the fundamental usage and distribution of resources, labor time, etc. A whole change in life is happening at this point in time, and this is when the book is written. 2 short years later, specifically on September 11th, 1973, a coup is carried out, led by a Chilean general by the name of Augusto Pinochet, whose name you should recognize, backed by and in many ways orchestrated by the CIA and other aspects of the United States military. He actually, they take over, they bomb the presidential palace. Allende dies in that bombing. He's shot, actually, and I think it's still speculation as to whether he shot himself or not, but clearly a military contingent had taken over the entirety of Chile, and they proceeded to implement a regime of disappearance for radicals and opposition, a regime of torture, using the same CIA overseers who had been active in Brazil, and who had derived their skills, their mode of operation from the expertise of the French in Algeria. So we get torture, we get unjust imprisonment, and we get the reopening of national resources, labor markets, and consumer markets again to northern United States capital. And the United States supports this dictator for the next, I forget my years, at least decade, maybe decade and a half. And this book is banned, and it is burned, and in 1975, the book is banned in the United States as well. So even though it's a hard thing to read because the Marxist vocabulary is unfamiliar to most of us, it is certainly a very interesting and historically important text. Okay, so what they're doing is just, they're criticizing Disney, right? And, you know, I put this in part, I think I need to reduce it and stuff, but I put it in part to, like, startle y'all, because everybody's supposed to think that, well, okay, there might be problems with the United States ideology, there might be problems with United States media, news media, all that kind of stuff, but Disney, that is sacrosanct. We cannot criticize Disney, because Disney is just magic and fun and beauty, and it's the greatest embellishment of childhood. And when I tell people that I will never take my kid to Disneyland, they're like, well, what kind of an evil dictatorial patriarch are you? You're going to deny your child all that fun. And I'm like, well, what fun was that? The fun of standing in the line, the fun of, like, being surveilled from all directions, the fun of being having, like, the American flag crammed down your throat, like, that fun? And no, they're like, you know, the fun of, like, you know, animals and Bambi and you know, like, innocence and all that sort of stuff. And so what Dorfman and Madelart are saying, and I agree with it, is that the supposed innocence of Disney is nothing but supposition. It's not really innocent at all. Disney is a conveyor of some of the harshest ideological conceptions, racist conceptions especially, that the world knows. And so they put their passion, you know, opposing capitalism, opposing the influence of the United States over their own resources, their own educational system, their own cultural system. They put all that energy of opposition, they focus it on this one particular phenomenon. And it's not just Disney, it's like all Donald Duck, right? And they sat down with, I think it's 100 different Donald Duck magazines, and they very carefully analyze all of them. And they try to see what are the regularities here. And what they end up saying is that while Disney purports to be all about childhood and all about innocence, and so it's not supposed to be political, it's outside of politics, it's not supposed to be economic, it's just about, like, children and the imagination, right? It's supposed to be all that stuff, but in fact it's the opposite on every front. First of all, of course, we have, you know, Disney selling shit all the time. They're selling the magazines. They're selling the toys that go along with the magazines. They're selling the movies that go along with the toys that go along with the magazines. It's all sales. And of course, those sales prey upon children, which is not the focus of Dorfman and Metal Art, although they hit it once in a while. But more importantly, Disney exhibits all the distinctive features of ideology as Marx and Engels had analyzed it. So we can start to think through these. Now, generally speaking, and now I'm looking at the notes. Generally speaking, what they want to say is that Disney broadcasts the worldview of the bourgeoisie, especially in the United States. That is, of the owning class, of the capitalists. And, you know, what the capitalists really want to do is convince us that there is no other way to live except in the way that they live. There's no other way to live except in the way that they want us to live. And they would very much like to look over, they would like to hide, this is what ideology does, they would like to hide the contradictions and the tensions within society. Now, how do they hide that? Well, you know, one simple answer to that in the Disney comics that they're talking about, and I will post some Disney clips and a clip with, I think it's Ariel Dorfman, Matalart, I don't think is in it, a little like video that will like kind of describe this historical period to you in the writing of the book. But one way in which that ideology works is there's a systematic exclusion of the domain of production. There's no mining. There's no, like, working in a factory. There's no, like, putting in long hours under a boss who pays you less than they really ought to. All that stuff disappears in Disney. Similarly, the whole domain of sex and reproduction disappears in Disney. So it's like Uncle Donald, right? Donald's not the father of Huey, Dewey, and Louie. He's their uncle. And this, you probably, if you tried to deal with this text, you probably hit this part and then gave up shortly afterwards. I hope you'd go back and try it again. But sexuality is hidden. The real world is hidden. History is hidden. And on the colonial front, the extraction of wealth from subjugated peoples is hidden. Those people themselves are hidden. And this is one of the most profound things that I think everybody should see in Disney if they pause to think for only a moment. The other of the United States, everybody across the world, Indians and Africans and Asians and everybody is reduced to these tourist style stereotypes. And so the populations of the world are hidden, especially the populations whose wealth Northern capital is constantly absorbing, or let's put it more simply, stealing, taking, in one or another variety of force. That whole world is hidden. It's all hidden. History is hidden. The development of production technology, the fact that humans are involved in their own history, it's all hidden. Independence movements, decolonial movements show up in Disney, but they show up as systematically ridiculed. Workers' movements, if they show up at all, look completely stupid and foolish. Everything that the bourgeoisie, everything that the owning class does not want to think about and doesn't want you to think about is systematically absent from Disney. Disney and the Donald Duck comics, according to these writers, are the paragon, the epitome of United States ideology, the epitome of the view that capital wants the rest of the world to have. And that means that Disney is systematic falsification. And then look, this goes even a step further, right? Because it's not just that Disney hides all the aspects of exploitation, of violence, of history, of possible other systems. And it does hide all these things from the population of the United States or even the population of the First World, which is benefiting in a systematic way from the exploitation of the rest of the globe. But then this society redistributes these falsified images of reality to the very people it most exploits, the colonized subjects of the rest of the world. And it becomes, the spectacle, we're back to the spectacle. The spectacle enters Chile, and it provides images for identification to the Chilean population, and especially to Chilean children, which are falsified representations, belittling representations, racist representations of themselves. And because, and so they enter, like African Americans in particular in the United States, into a situation of double consciousness, where they have one experience of themselves as potentially active, real thinking people in situations of real power, where real struggle has to happen, where real courage and real cowardice occur, where there really are powers and enemies. They have this sense of like really being Chileans, really being Africans, really being Native Americans. But then they also have this model systematically and repeatedly offered to them, like, here's who you are. And the you with whom they are supposed to identify is stupid, backwards, silly, removed from progress, an impediment to progress. And there's this constant battle going on between who they are and who they are supposed to think they are. And that is arguably the function of the distribution of this ideology to the rest of the world. Of course, it's more complicated than that, because Disney also digs getting paid by the Chileans, right? And what the United States' influence over Chile facilitates is, among other things, the culture market. It offers that market to Northern Capital, in this case, Disney Capital. Okay, so let's just step through the things that are hidden here. And then I'll just ask you to check out some of the videos that I'm going to post and see if this stuff doesn't make sense to you. And, you know, what would be awesome is if in the aftermath, those of you who think Disney is awesome didn't think that anymore. That would be so cool. Okay. First of all, there's hiding going on here, which I talked about, I guess. There's a misrepresentation of children and childhood. Now, think about this. Like, we're really supposed to believe, and most people do believe this, and recognize that this is a part of Disney's decades-long advertising scheme, its branding procedure for itself, that Disney is all about innocence, and it's all about childhood, right? But what Dorfman and Matalart say is that, well, actually, the real features of children, the distinguishing features of children, and they list off trust, spontaneity, unconditional love, imagination, these are all actually absent from the children in Disney. So the children in Disney don't actually represent children. Now, of course, if my kid or your kid watches Huey, Dewey, and Louie, they're going to identify with Huey, Dewey, and Louie, right? Like, they're the kids. They're going to see themselves. They're going to know they're supposed to identify in this way. But what Huey and Dewey and Louie are doing is not trusting openly, is not engaging in spontaneous activity, is not engaging in unconditional love, is not exploring their imagination. Actually, what they're doing is they're modeling adult values to the kids. And they say, you know, and this is all included within, what is it called? The Junior Woodchuck Handbook. And they're like, okay, so it looks like the children and it's never parents, right? The older people, the dominators versus the dominated. It looks like there's something liberatory about Disney because there are so many cases in which the kids end up schooling the adults. But their point is that, like, they only school the adults. They only end up being the dominators versus the dominated when the adults fail to abide by the values of the adults themselves. And what are those values? Dead center of all of it, respect for private property, right? And of course, we have to do all kinds of contortions in order to make this square with systematic representations of systematic plundering of colonial territories. But they do make it work, right? Anyway, when the children get on top, they only get on top because they are model adults. It's not the tendencies of children, which also probably include cruelty and all kinds of other things. It's not childishness that gets Huey, Dewey, and Louie into a position where they get to school Uncle Scrooge or Uncle Donald. Rather, it is when Uncle Donald or Uncle Scrooge violate the principles of adult life, in that case, then the children become the representatives of the actual adult value set. So it's a trick. Like what they're saying is that Disney's child characters, which are clearly the models with which children viewing Disney are going to identify, pretend to be childlike, but in fact, they are the models for the later adult world. They are the placeholders for adult values. Okay, what about women? Well, this doesn't take much work, right? Women in the comics that they've been analyzing, maybe we have some slight attempt to, on the surface, change these things in Disney in the present. But even when you get, like, heroic female characters, they've all still got to be really hot, right? They've got to be, like, you know, like, they model, like, dominant ideas about sexual attractiveness, all this kind of stuff. So I think that, like, the belittling of females still goes on in Disney. And they say, okay, so in 1971, all the females that are represented in the Donald Duck comics are, they're always subordinate. They're usually trophies to be acquired or wooed by the male characters. The only good characters are either like humble servants doing women's work, or they're sex objects. They're constantly courted beauty queens. And like Daisy is like this. Or, you know, you can do these kind of analyses for other things too, right? What about the Smurfs? You know, what is Smurfette's role in the Smurfs? Well, she's the hot one. She's the girl that everybody wants, right? She's a sex object. Or what about, like, my son a few years ago was, like, super into the, what are they called? Like, the new Disney fairy series. There's a whole series of movies. I mean, I'm watching that with Tinkerbell and stuff, right? It's not Peter Pan, but there's, like, a whole spinoff with, like, you know, Tinkerbell and the Land of Fairies. And I'm watching that stuff, and I'm like, wow, you know, Tinkerbell's kind of hot, right? Tinkerbell's got great legs, and I don't mean to offend anybody here, but I think I'm not making a sexist or problematic comment there. I'm just pointing out that Tinkerbell is sexualized. Now, to my son, he doesn't think about it in that way, but he certainly has internalized whatever came across to those movies because he watched them a whole bunch of times, right? So there, Disney is not neutral with respect to the representation of women. They either become humble servants or they become sex objects. And then on a broader scale, there is a possibility for women, as represented within Disney, to be good or evil. And if they're good, they're like Snow White, or they're like Daisy. And then they're like, you know, the sexy object of male desire, to be wooed and acquired. Or they're evil. And anybody who does not match these first two options, they're not a humble servant and they're not like a passive sex object, becomes evil. And then they become like Sylvia the vampire. And then even worse stuff goes on when it comes to the representation of people in colonized territories. And you get like really long, I'm not going to go through this stuff, but you should check out the text because they give you really exhaustive examples of what shows up just in the Donald Duck comics, which are clearly representations of the rest of the world. So like Aztec land, for example, is like really clearly a representation of Mexico, but it's the most pejorative, racist possible depiction of Mexico. And then of course, the complication here is that this is not just a racist representation of the colonized other for the colonizer. The racist representation of the colonized other is then distributed to the colonized other as an aspect of their colonization. Okay. What happens with respect to colonized people? They're considered to be natives, and these natives are categorized as ahistorical or prehistorical. And by the way, like if you did give up, I would say at least go back and check out this section, because this part is easy reading. It just gives you like a tourist guide to you know, the Donald Duck Disney world of the colonized, and it describes in pretty hilarious detail, I mean hilarious in a very cynical and disturbing way, All the things that are portrayed as true of colonial subjects in the Disney world. So I'm not going to go through all of them, but the basic idea is that, or one of the most dominant ideas, is that people in what I suppose we should call the global South are outside of the progress of history. They are tied to the land in some way. They are unaware of contemporary technology. And when they see contemporary technology, they always assume it's magic. And because they're so naive and they're so childish, I mean, like, greater childishness is represented in the colonized subject than is represented in the city children, the nephew ducks. There's more childishness, naivete, in the colonized. And this ends up being a sort of endlessly reiterated and kind of disgusting rationalization of colonial plunder, because the basic argument seems to be that these people are so backwards, they're so close to nature, that they don't really need any of the resources that the global North can really use. You know, they don't care about gold, they don't care about coal, they don't care about oil, they don't care about aluminum, they don't care about lithium. You know, all these different things that we need to pull out of the ground in order to run our sophisticated industries. The natives don't care about that stuff because they're all just attached to nature. And maybe even by taking that stuff off of their hands, and sometimes even cutting them in on the deal, right, so that their nation gets a tiny fragment of the profit being made by the multinationals, we're doing them a favor because we let them just go back to being natural and basic and fat and dark and stupid in the way that they naturally are. I mean, tremendously racist depiction of the Third World. And the reason that there's so much passionate indignation on the part of these Chilean writers is, again, because it's not just that the global North or the United States lies to itself about the people they oppress. It's that these lies are then visited upon the oppressed children themselves. So that a part of the domination of global Northern capital is the domination of the imagination by Disney, which inscribes the owner capitalist Northern attitude towards the subjugated in the subjugated themselves. This ideology, Disney's ideology, Disney itself, systematically disempowers individuals. Individuals in the exploited world, and this is probably true of workers in the first world too. Okay. Anyway, so another point is that there's never any, like, mining. There's never any, like, forced labor. Scrooge McDuck and whoever's working for him are always finding all this treasure in Aztec land or wherever it is. But it wasn't manufactured. You know, it has no history. And it's of no use to the people who are there. It's just discovered. And the only thing that was necessary in order to discover this wealth and bring it back to Scrooge McDuck's, like, bath of money, the only thing that was necessary was the cleverness, the alleged important ideas, the intelligence of the Northern capitalist. So supposedly, these white folks up in the United States are way smarter than the people down south who aren't as white, even if they look kind of whitish, not as white, and not as smart. And because these people in the colonized world are not as clever as the ones up north, well, of course, they're not the ones who are going to find the treasure. But it doesn't matter anyway, because the treasure was of no use to them. So what's hidden in that? What's hidden in that is, like, every possible dimension of exploitation. The fact that, of course, every nation can use its own resources. And that, of course, in order to get gold, you don't just go find it. You push men into the ground where they very often die in order to dig it out while living in subsistence circumstances. And then, of course, if you really want to get into it, you know, like, what's gold mining like? Well, you know, you got these, like, ponds full of, what is the poison that they use in order to separate out gold from, like, surrounding material? Maybe it's arsenic. So you have these big pools of poison, which sometimes are unleashed on surrounding areas. I mean, like, there's just utter devastation that goes along with the extraction of resources from any colonial territory. Utter devastation of lives, of environment, of bodies. And all of that is systematically hidden in Disney. Now you might think that all this is like over the top and like, oh, but Disney's just fun. Why do we need to look into this stuff? Well, the answer is Disney's not just fun. Disney is money-making, but Disney is also indoctrination. That's the claim. And I would urge you to think about that too. Like, you know, our values come from certain places. Our values are non-neutral. Our values are distributed and selected by a small sector of the society, and they have an agenda, and there are certain things that they want us to think and other things they definitely don't want us to think. Disney is non-neutral. It's not just happiness. I'm sorry to burst your bubble. If you want happiness, go make out with your lover, you know? But Disney is a technology of control. And then lastly, this stuff affects the first world too, and the lower class in the first world, because the other thing that is excluded is the entire production process. All the workers are excluded. Now, of course, they do say there are plenty of workers, actually, but not productive workers. So we have service workers, we have door-to-door salesmen, we have maybe we have cooks in restaurants, but we don't have miners. And we don't have steel workers, and we don't have anybody who, like, we don't have any depiction of big groups of people who sacrifice their entire day and their entire week and their entire year and their entire life to alienated work because they have no other option. This is the proletariat in Marxist terms, right? To be proletarianized means to be forced into a circumstance where you can no longer satisfy your own needs or the needs of your children. And was, you know, one key aspect of proletarianization historically would be like the uprooting of peasants and the movement of them into the cities. As a peasant, now, of course, people lived very poorly and in subjugated conditions, but they were able to raise food to take care of themselves. When they get pushed into the cities, there's no longer a cow. There's no longer a field. There is nothing. There's food, but it's alienated from you. It's behind that door over there. And if you figure out how to get through the door and get the food, well, then you're going to go to jail and maybe you're going to be shot. You cannot have that food unless you work for the man over here. That is proletarianization, right? There's no representation of proletarian experience ever in any way in Disney. The closest that we come, they say, is to systematically distorted representations of the working class, which also operate basically like the representations of colonial subjects work. They operate upon individuals in such a way that produces double consciousness and that for the owners lets them think whatever it is that makes them happy. You know, what the owners would like to think is like, you know, those people down there, they're not our problem. They're really stupid. They're kind of quaint. They're really close to the earth. They don't mind working because they're not smart enough to do anything else anyway. That's like, what, 99? That's the 99%. Too fucking stupid to really do anything except obey us. That's what the owners would like to think. And let me tell you, I'm not an owner, but I think I'm plenty smart to disagree with them, right? I don't respect their right to not recognize what 99% of the population does. But Disney does. So we're either, this is what Dorfman and Matillard say, there's two representations of the working class. One is the peasant, which is sort of like the colonized subject, close to the land, cute, stupid, sometimes fat, often quite dark, right? So all this stuff is racialized to hell. And then the other depiction is of criminals. So there's always these criminals, and they are always racialized. And they're always, they diverge from dominant norms of beauty, which in themselves are, you know, problematic. But they're big, they're cumbersome, they're supposedly unattractive, they're always dark, they're always dumb. So these are the representations of the working class. They can either be stupid and archaic, in which case they become kind of like a sentimental connection for the general population, or if they get out of line in any way, they're criminals. And by the way, criminals are stupid. There's good people and bad people in the Disney world, but the difference between good and bad is determined along completely bourgeois owner lines. That is, the good person is the one who is quote-unquote honest, and that means the person who has respect for private property. And the bad person is one who is dishonest, which means the one who has no respect for private property. And then lastly, they give an analysis of, like, Donald, right? So Donald's always trying to get work, but he's always trying to do it for, like, stupid reasons. He's not proletarianized. It's not that, like, he's got a struggle where he can't eat or he can't get health care for his kids. There's no real problems. His problem is always that he can't, like, make the last installment on his TV. It's all about entertainment, right? And so, like money-making is nice because it gets you luxuries, but it's not something that people have to do. There's therefore no exploitation, right? And then Donald is often getting fired, but the representation of the nature of his firing is just that he's totally incompetent, or that he just chooses not to really do that work anymore. And this becomes a stand-in for the working class as a whole. If there's unemployment, if people suffer, if they're poor, if they starve, if their children suffer, that's because their parents are fucking incompetent. And what can we owners, because the whole thing is from the perspective of the owners, right? This is DeBord too, right? The spectacle is the non-stop discourse of the ruling order about itself. And if you want to understand that, go back to Chomsky and the control over media flows. If people are unemployed, if they suffer, it's because they're incompetent, and or it's because of the free decisions that they have made and now they're suffering for it. This is a contemporary conservative view too, right? People are homeless. Well, you know, they shouldn't have fucking done drugs. What do they expect? It's not my problem. It's their free choice, right? So the owner view is that, like, anything that is produced systematically through the system that benefits the owners is actually the fault of the people who experience it. Okay, so, like, let me just say one more time. I hope that you will think again about Disney and about cartoons in general and recognize that the things that we think of as being innocent and only entertainment are no such thing.